This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 11, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Sharon ploughs on with his West Bank military onslaught as Powell arrives in Jerusalem. Meanwhile in Washington, civil disobedience on the steps of the State Department protests the U.S.'s unqualified support for Israel. The Bush administration wants to train the Colombian military to fight terrorists. And Earth First activists Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney's case versus the FBI and Oakland Police Department is underway. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. UN officials in Beirut and Lebanese politicians warned today that the military escalation at the Israel-Lebanon border over the past 10 days could soon get out of hand. Maha Al-Azhar reports from Beirut.
Today, Hezbollah fighters bombarded three Israeli army posts in the disputed Sheba Farms, sparking immediate retaliation by Israeli artillery. The Sheba Farms were captured by Israel from Syria in the 1967 Middle East War and are now claimed by Lebanon with Damascus's verbal yet not official consent. Yesterday, Hezbollah conducted its heaviest bombardment since 1992 on the same disputed land, with Israel responding by hitting several Hezbollah positions. There have been no casualties up till now. This was Maha Al-Azhar, Beirut, for Free Speech Radio News.
The murder of a UN worker in northern Afghanistan raises questions about the UN's repatriation of Afghan refugees. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
Shah Syed, an Afghan working for the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, was shot dead in his home yesterday in the northern city of Mazar-i-Sharif. Robbery did not appear to be the motive, according to UN officials, who cited a pattern of attacks on civilians in the northern provinces in recent months. Meanwhile, the International Relief Organization MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, is criticizing what it calls a premature repatriation effort begun Tuesday by the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. Under an agreement with the Iranian government and the interim Afghan administration, UNHCR aims to assist up to 400,000 Afghans to return voluntarily to their homes. MSF says some are being forcibly returned to face possible persecution and starvation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
60 nations around the globe have committed to ratifying the International Criminal Court. Hundreds cheered as the United Nations chief legal officer announced the court would be implemented in July of 2002. The court will not hear any offenses committed before that date. Yet China and the United States take exception to the court's creation. President Bush is trying to remove the U.S. signature, supported by President Clinton, and is strongly encouraging other allies to do the same. A British court agreed to mediate the claims of Kenyan herders whose loved ones, especially children, were maimed or killed by unexploded bombs. Anastasia Kershaw has more from London.
More than 200 people killed or maimed by unexploded weapons on British Army firing ranges in Kenya are looking for $6 million in compensation, it was revealed today. Most of the accidents near Mount Kenya affected children from the Maasai and Samburu tribes as they played on government firing ranges, which are also tribal land. Few can read the signs the army put up, mostly in English, to warn against handling leftover munitions. Although the Ministry of Defence in London denies legal liability for the accidents because they had no obligation to pick up munitions, ministry officials say they are prepared to settle claims. A compensation hearing will take place in July and more cases are expected to surface. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Anastasia Kershaw in London.
The New Mexico Supreme Court has added federal Indian law as a subject on the state bar exam, becoming the first state in the country to do so. Leslie Clark reports from Albuquerque.
Indian law will be one of the 23 subjects test takers might see on the essay portion of the New Mexico bar exam. Prospective lawyers won't be expected to know the laws of each of the state's 22 Indian tribes, but will be tested on broader issues of Indian law. Lawyers in New Mexico are confronted with questions of Indian law in areas like child welfare, jurisdiction, taxation, and water rights. Attorneys say testing on Indian law makes sense because of the growing importance of Indian affairs, with Indian casinos one of the highest-profile issues across the nation in recent years. February 2003 is the first time an Indian law question could appear on the New Mexico bar exam. Other Western states are considering adding Indian law to their bar exams in the future. I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Palestinian Liberation Organization has been evicted from its downtown Washington office for failure to pay rent. Hassan Abdel Rahman, the PLO's chief representative in Washington, confirmed the eviction today and said the reasons were political. He acknowledged that rental payments had been in arrears, but said similar problems in the past had been resolved amicably with the landlord. This time, he said, the landlord would not negotiate. He attributed the eviction to widespread sympathy for Israel in Washington. Meanwhile, the notion of international intervention in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has been gaining momentum in the recent days, will be squarely on the agenda as U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell meets with both Sharon and Arafat, bringing the idea of stationing U.S. observers in the region. However, Israel and the United States appeared at odds over two key issues: the speed of the Israeli withdrawal and the role of Yasser Arafat, who's been confined to a few rooms in his West Bank headquarters for the past 2 weeks. Sharon acknowledged today that his military offensive was causing the United States difficulties, an apparent reference to growing anti-American sentiment in many Arab countries in response to Israel's military offensive. Inside the Jenin refugee camps, homes have been flattened by army bulldozers, walls blackened by fire, and the streets chewed up by dozens of armored vehicles. An Israeli army spokesperson said army bulldozers were demolishing buildings in the camp, though he did not say how many. Israeli troops confiscated footage of the camp filmed by an Associated Press television news camera earlier today. Many of the 13,000 residents of Jenin have fled the military, sleeping in homes and mosques in nearby towns. Kristen Scher caught up with some of the people fleeing and files this report from Jenin.
In Taiba and Romani, two towns near Jenin, where there are reports of at least 300 dead and countless tortured and injured, 548 Palestinian men now living in Romani have been dumped by Israeli soldiers at nearby Salem checkpoint after having been arrested from Jenin. 200 were dumped naked outside Taiba. Each day, new groups arrive. I've heard several stories of horror from the men. A Palestinian United Nations Relief Works Agency employee was detained at a checkpoint for 3 days without food and only Israeli soldier urine to drink. The right side of his face is paralyzed due to severe beating. The Israeli interrogators, described as torturers, told the imprisoned man that all UNRWA employees are spies for Hezbollah. When asking the Israeli doctor to loosen his extremely tight plastic handcuffs, the doctor only tightens them further. His home in Jenin caught fire, which was saved by firefighters, only to be bombed by an Apache helicopter hours later. He does not know what has become of his family. A young Palestinian man was forced from his home in Jenin and used as a human shield by Israeli soldiers. His back and neck are burned by cigarettes. A Palestinian Red Crescent ambulance driver was arrested after feeding 200 women and children for 3 days outside Jenin refugee camp. When the food ran out, the 200 left the medical center, heading for the eastern side of Jenin. All were stopped, while some women and all of the men were forced to strip naked. At this school in Taiba, which is serving as a refugee camp for the arrested from Jenin refugee camp, there is a list on the wall of those detainees released from Salem checkpoint. In nearby Romani, the mosque loudspeaker, which otherwise projects the call to prayer, calls out names of the missing and disappeared from Jenin. In Jenin, there is no electricity, so recharging cell phones is impossible, as is getting television news. There is no food and no water. Communication and information gathering in and out of the camp and surrounding area is next to impossible. None of the refugees from Jenin refugee camp are allowed to return. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Kristen Scher reporting from Taiba, Palestine.
Earlier today, Michael Lerner and Cornel West participated in nonviolent civil disobedience in front of the State Department to protest the U.S. role in the ongoing Israeli siege. Gareth Schweitzer reports from the State Department in Washington.
Down by the riverside, down by the riverside.
The protest of approximately 200 people gathered with Israeli and Palestinian flags at the State Department to protest the leadership of both sides in the conflict. The protest was led by African-American activist and scholar Cornel West, as well as Rabbi Michael Lerner, the editor of the critical Jewish magazine Tikkun. West expressed the protesters' unity with those suffering on both sides of the conflict.
We are in solidarity with the suffering of Palestinian brothers and sisters and Israeli brothers and sisters. It's a matter of ensuring that we keep track of the humanity of each and every one of them across the board.
Demonstrators included both Arabs and Jews, many of whom sat in protest in the street outside the front entrance of the State Department. Rabbi Lerner issued a harsh critique of Ariel Sharon, noting that the Israeli prime minister does not speak for Jews around the world.
We want to say to Ariel Sharon and to the people who follow him that you do not speak in the name of the Jewish people, that the Jewish people are a people of love and compassion.
More than 20 protesters who were subsequently arrested sang "Give Peace a Chance" as police moved in. Cornel West was the first man arrested, followed soon after by Rabbi Lerner. Participants in today's protest will return to the streets again on April 20th for another anti-war demonstration, this time at the White House. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Today, the International Criminal Court came into being without the support of the United States. Other nations that also did not sign on included Iraq, Libya, and Iran. Meantime, this news just in from Yugoslavia, a top ally of Slobodan Milosevic has shot himself in front of the federal parliament in Yugoslavia rather than be sent to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. Milosevic's Minister of the Interior was to be shipped to The Hague under a new law approved by the federal parliament, authorizing top socialist officials to be shipped to The Hague. Jeremy Scahill reports from Belgrade.
The former head of the Serbian police, Vlajko Stojiljković, walked out of the federal parliament building in downtown Belgrade shortly after 7 p.m. local time. Stojiljković stood alone quietly on the steps to the building before raising a Beretta pistol to his head and pulling the trigger. Eyewitnesses say Stojiljković was still alive and writhing on the ground when ambulances arrived on the scene. Vlajko Stojiljković was indicted on charges of crimes against humanity along with Slobodan Milosevic and three others during the 1999 Kosovo War. This week, Yugoslavia's government passed a law on cooperation with the Hague Tribunal, paving the way for Stojiljković's imminent extradition. But Vlajko Stojiljković has always said he would die before allowing himself to be sent to The Hague. And tonight, his political allies from the Socialist Party of Serbia released a statement written by Stojiljković in which he blames his death on Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic, Yugoslav President Vojislav Koštunica, and the new government in Belgrade, who he called traitors and NATO servants. This incident comes at a time here in Serbia when the issue of cooperating with The Hague is being hotly debated. Last week, Washington threatened to impose fresh sanctions on the country if it did not send more people to The Hague. Still, many people in Serbia oppose The Hague Tribunal and what they call Washington's attempts at blackmail. Vlajko Stojiljković could become a martyr in the battle against a court, which Slobodan Milosevic calls a private court for American justice. Ironically, this all comes on a day when the United Nations has ratified a treaty on the establishment of a permanent international criminal court. The U.S. refuses to sign that treaty and has worked diligently to try to block its creation, saying Washington will not allow its officials to be put on trial for war crimes. Yugoslavia is a signer of that treaty, and it was something that former President Slobodan Milosevic had supported for years. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
The White House sent its controversial new State Department representative for the Western Hemisphere to Capitol Hill today. Ambassador Otto Reich was a key figure in the Reagan-era Iran-Contra scandal. Now he's asking Congress to approve a military role for the U.S. in Colombia to fight terrorism. Currently, U.S. aid to Colombia can only be used for counter-narcotic efforts, but the administration wants to change that. Some in Congress worry the White House is using the so-called war on terrorism as an excuse to pad the pockets of military contractors and petroleum interests. Joshua Chafin reports from the Capitol.
Under President Ronald Reagan, Otto Reich ran a covert propaganda campaign to sell the American people on the administration's efforts against Central American leftists. A federal investigation found Reich's office had broken the law, but Reich was never indicted. He says he's proud of everything the U.S. did in Latin America in the 80s, but today he promised the State Department would follow the letter of the law. In the House International Relations Committee, Reich made the White House's case for a more militaristic U.S. role in Colombia.
We seek new, explicit legal authorities to support a unified campaign against narcotics trafficking, terrorist activities, and other threats to its national security. These new authorities recognize that the terrorist and narcotics problems in Colombia are inextricably intertwined.
In front of the committee, Reich compared the leftist guerrillas in Colombia to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda. But some Democrats on the committee likened increasing the U.S. role in Colombia to the beginnings of the Vietnam War. Even Texas Republican Congressman Ron Paul said the proposal sounded like a money-making opportunity for military contractors.
To pan this off as something current, dealing with terrorism, dealing with 9/11, I think is just really a stretch. I represent a rather modestly poor district in Texas. I have never had one individual come up and say, you know, I really need to be further taxed because I like what you're doing in Colombia.
Colombian farmers produce as much as 90% of the cocaine consumed in the USA. North Carolina Republican Cass Ballinger said, quote, terrorists are the root of the problem. New Jersey Democrat Robert Menendez suggested the root cause might be the American demand for drugs. Democrats worried there's too little emphasis on alternative development programs to wean Colombian farmers away from growing illicit crops. But Ambassador Reich said as much as a quarter of the president's Colombia budget would go to alternative development.
We have asked for $439 million in our fiscal year 03 budget request to sustain our Plan Colombia programs, as well as $98 million to train and equip Colombian military units protecting the Cano Limón oil pipeline.
The Caño Limón oil pipeline has been bombed by guerrillas more than 100 times in the past year, which Reich calls an environmental disaster. But critics of the American Colombia policy point out that the pipeline is partly owned by an American concern, Occidental Oil. Again, Texas Republican Congressman Ron Paul.
So we're down there. We're being the police force for Occidental. Now, if Occidental all of a sudden makes a lot more profits, do you think it would be proper, and this is a question, do you think it would be proper for us to then precisely tax Occidental to reimburse us for going down there and securing their oil pipeline?
Adam Isaacson watches Colombia policy with the Center for International Policy in D.C. He says most people in Congress don't know what they're getting into.
The picture they have in their heads of Colombia is more like Honduras, where you can move in and the U.S. can just do what it wants and get its objectives fulfilled. But Colombia is much more complicated and much bigger by a matter of degree than most of the sort of these second-tier states that we're sending troops to now as part of the war on terrorism, like Georgia or Yemen. This is much bigger. You've got 40,000 insurgents controlling territory. I mean, you can call them terrorists, but it doesn't change the way you'd have to fight them if you were to get serious about a military mission in Colombia. Leaving aside the entire question of the fact that the Colombian military is still in bed in many parts of the country with the paramilitaries, and any aid we give them could end up doing more damage than good.
The White House proposal for a greater U.S. military role in Colombia is expected to pass the House. Passage in the democratically controlled Senate is less assured. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
With the Los Angeles Police Commission's 4-1 decision not to reappoint the chief and the city council unlikely to override the commission, Parks' career as police chief will end in August. Free Speech Radio News' Justin Stinchcomb reports on the controversy surrounding Parks, the LAPD, and the legacy of racism and corruption at the LAPD.
In February, Los Angeles Mayor James Hahn announced he wouldn't support Bernard Parks for a second term. But the mayor doesn't choose the police chief directly. He's chosen by the police commission. The commissioners are themselves appointed by the mayor. And the mayor's announcement has brought charges that he interfered in the decision, betraying the trust of Black Los Angeles, who helped elect Hahn on the understanding that he'd keep Parks. Parks says the commission's meetings, which have been held in secret, should have been open to public scrutiny.
I did not have the opportunity to put forward my plans for the future of this department in a public forum. While I understand the confidential personnel matters cannot be discussed in public, I do believe most of my presentation could have easily been held in open session.
Parks has said that he'll continue to push for reappointment. Under the city charter, he could win another 5-year term if he could convince 10 council members to override the police commission's decision. But Parks has just 3 potential supporters in the African American council members. When Parks joined the force 38 years ago, it was an unspoken rule that black officers were unwelcome on the top floor of Parker Center, where he now has his office. And the issue of race is at the heart of the controversy about his reappointment. LAPD Sergeant Ronnie Cato is a Parks supporter. He says Parks' defeat means a defeat for racial diversity in a department in which black officers have for decades felt they were butting their heads against a glass ceiling of racism.
If you put yourself in a position to be promoted, you would be promoted now. So it gave African-American officers hope that now they would be graded or judged on how well they did on the promotional test.
Cato leads the Oscar Joel Bryant Foundation, an organization of black police officers. He sees Parks' defeat as a victory for the police union, the Protective League. And that, he says, means a victory for institutional racism. In his view, the Protective League's relentless campaign against Parks is simply a racial vendetta. The League has never had a black board member. Cato says he won't forget Hahn's early statement of opposition to a second term for Parks. The controversy has pitted Los Angeles black leadership against those who say Parks must go for his failure to reform the department. These same reformers, however, find themselves in an uncomfortable alliance with the allegedly racist Protective League. USC Law Professor Erwin Chemerinsky.
I find myself on the opposite side of black leaders who I'm almost always affiliated with, and we're always fighting together for things. I think that the Police Protective League has a history of racism. They've never had an African-American director. On the other hand, they also reflect genuine concerns of the rank and file that the chief of police has been arbitrary and capricious in imposing discipline, not simply tough.
Chemerinsky says Parks has never fully addressed the brutality at the heart of the Rampart scandal, in which planted evidence, station house beatings, and widespread corruption in a single precinct of the LAPD led to scores of overturned convictions.
The underlying causes of Rampart, the deep problems in Los Angeles Police Department, have not been addressed. 10 years ago, the Christopher Commission said there'll never be an effective disciplinary system until we deal with the code of silence. And nothing has been done in the LAPD to deal with the code of silence. There's no whistleblower protection. No officer can speak anonymously without fear of reprisal in reporting wrongdoing by other officers. The overall disciplinary system has not been changed, and we're not going to deal with the underlying problems of abuse and corruption until we reform that system.
Ramona Ripston of the ACLU says Parks should be commended for attempting to discipline the department, if he did so even-handedly. She's concerned about Parks' handling of officer-involved shootings, particularly the case of Margaret Mitchell, a mentally ill homeless woman who was shot by LAPD officers. But ultimately, Ripston says, Parks' leadership was undermined by his inflexibility.
I think he knew the department. I think he could have been a great police chief. He was just too stubborn. He just wouldn't listen to people. He did it all. He thought he was the imperial police chief.
The city council has 10 working days to change its mind on hearing Parks' case. After that, the police commission will begin the search for his replacement. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Justin Stinchcomb in Los Angeles.
After 2 full days of jury selection, the 12 jurors heard opening statements in the case of Earth First activists Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney versus the FBI and the Oakland Police Department. In 1990, a pipe bomb exploded while the 2 environmentalists were traveling on an Oakland freeway, shattering Barry's pelvis, dislocating vertebrae, and causing severe intestinal damage. Following the bombing, the FBI and the Oakland Police Department arrested Barry and Cherney for transporting explosives, but prosecutors later refused to file charges, saying the FBI had no evidence to support the claim. In the 11 years since the case was filed, the bombing remains unsolved, and Judy Barry died of breast cancer in 1997. Carter Mester has more from the Oakland Federal Courthouse.
During his opening statement, Joseph Scher, lead counsel for the U.S. Department of Justice, described Earth First as an organization known for property damage and violence. Scher then proceeded to introduce the defendants to the jury, one by one, describing the role each FBI agent played during the 1990 investigation. Scher spoke of what he called the defendants' commitment to the environment and the recent roles they play in their latest assignments, fighting George Bush's war on terrorism.
I think he was trying to tweak the jury every minute about terrorism. You know, they're doing important activities now in Afghanistan or, you know, in that area of the world.
Tony Serra is one of the lead attorneys for Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney.
What he was really trying to do is avoid our evidence, not answer, you know, questions of falsehood and deception by these law officers, and shift the jury's attention to their laudable qualities. Like, I almost threw up when he started inducing one. Oh, he's not only a father, he's a grandfather, and he has two young grandchildren. What has that to do, you know, what he did in 1990, or more importantly, what he failed to do?
In a separate opening statement, Maria B., counsel for the city of Oakland, told jurors the Oakland Police Department lacked the expertise to handle domestic terrorism and relied on the FBI for information. Attorney B refused to comment and referred us to Karen Boyd, Oakland Legal Communications Director.
We responded since this happened in our community, but in order to proceed with the investigation, we did rely on information that we received from FBI experts. They have extensive expertise in bombs and explosives, so we relied on that data to proceed with the investigation.
Lawyers for the FBI continued their defense by telling the jury that at the time of the bombing, the agents were working on important cases like hunting for the Unabomber, rooting out domestic cells of the Irish Republican Army, and preparing for Operation Desert Shield.
I think everything he said was very thin excuse for non-performance, non-investigation, and I think the opening was a disgrace.
Again, Tony Serra.
Once analyzed, you know, it was, we were too busy, sorry. And Oakland fingered the FBI. All they said, hey, we didn't have any experts. These were homicide investigators. They had never gone to the bomb site before. They took all of their information from the FBI. So you have Oakland pointing to the FBI as the culprit, and the FBI in essence saying they were too busy, you know, to properly investigate. So in terms of substance, in terms of a real defense, in terms of explaining evidence, wholly lacking. A real joke.
Once the opening statements concluded, the first four witnesses called by the attorneys for Berry and Cherney took the stand. As pictures of the bombed car were shown to jurors, an Oakland firefighter and an Oakland bomb technician described the aftermath of the explosion. A former Seeds of Peace member who was driving ahead of Judy Berry's car when it blew up testified the police willfully mischaracterized Earth First's reputation while refusing to investigate the death threats sent to Judy Berry. On the witness stand, a longtime Earth First activist told the jury that Berry and Cherney were instrumental to renouncing the practice of tree spiking and advocated complete nonviolence. The first defendant is expected to take the witness stand when the trial reopens next week. At the Oakland Federal Courthouse, with help from Bob Stern, I'm Kata Mester.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Deepa Fernandez.